RNIB Connect Radio, celebrating 20 years of broadcasting around the UK.
You're listening to Roundtable Talks on RNIB Connect Radio, where blind and partially sighted people from different walks of life come together to discuss a big topic. And today we'll be talking about the pressures which impact the lives of blind and partially sighted people. At RNIB, we know there are multiple barriers which can stop people in our community living life as they want to. These can include facing discrimination and negative societal attitudes, having to navigate inaccessible environments and technology, experiencing social isolation, not having equal access to opportunities, and more. Facing all of these pressures can be incredibly tiring and difficult, but there is a wide range of support to reduce the burden they place on blind and partially sighted people. Today, we'll hear about the pressures faced by our panellists and how they cope with them. I'm Amelia Hilton, today's moderator, and it's time for us to introduce our panellists. First is Toby Davey, who is a familiar voice to the listeners of RNIB Connect Radio as our resident art expert and Tracks of My Life host. Toby has worked in the world of photography and radio and was deputy director of Vocalise for over a decade before joining the station in 2020. Outside of the arts, he's an accomplished sailor, having represented Great Britain at national, international and world blind sailing championships, winning a number of silver and gold medals. Welcome, Toby.
Thank you very much indeed, Amelia.
Our next panellist is Kieran Saeed, a disability consultant focusing on access to museums, galleries, heritage sites and theatres. She provides support and advice on independent living to the blind and partially sighted community and is a professional actor, playwright and founder of Visually Impaired Creators of Scotland, or VIX. Welcome, Kieran.
Delighted to be here.
And last, but by no means least, we have Callum Stoneman, who will also be a familiar voice to listeners of Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio. He began exploring the world of accessible technology aged 10, and his interest grew to eventually study computer networks and security at university. He's now Digital Accessibility Specialist at BT, and in his spare time, loves trying out new recipes in his kitchen. Welcome, Callum.
Hey, Amelia. Hi, everyone. Great to be here.
Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Let's get right into a big question. So I'm going to start with Toby. Do you feel pressure to be an ambassador for blind and partially sighted people when living your everyday life?
Gosh, that's a big question, Amelia. I think there is pressure on us as all, as visually impaired people, no matter what you do in life. I think some people see you as maybe a bit of an ambassador, a bit of a role model, a bit of an inspiration and all that kind of stuff, which I don't really necessarily feel myself. I'm just somebody who's just going out there doing my own thing and just getting on with life in whatever way it might be. But then again, I suppose, if what I do and people seeing what I do or hearing what I do on the radio and that kind of stuff, if that's inspiring somebody else or making somebody else think, yeah, I can do that as a visually impaired person, I think that's possibly a good thing, but I don't necessarily like the title myself.
Yeah, it is a really tough one. I mean, it always makes me cringe a little bit when the inspiration comment comes up, because it's always meant in the nicest possible way, and it's meant as a compliment. It's meant as, you know, you're amazing or, you know, brave or whatever else they come out with. But for me, it's always just exactly as you said, I'm not doing anything amazing. I'm just trying to get on with my life and be a normal person. There's always a bit of awkwardness for me when that comes up, because they're not trying to be patronizing, I don't think, most of the time. They're just seeing something that they couldn't possibly picture. When I say they, I'm talking about, you know, sighted people, really. But they just couldn't imagine our way of life. So I guess to them it is inspiring, but it's just us trying to be normal, everyday people.
I think for me, it's kind of like, who am I inspiring? That's my question. It's like, am I inspiring myself? Am I inspiring anyone else to do something? Am I inspiring sighted people to kind of know, well, it's tricky to do certain things in a different way? I don't know. And I think that's my big question, is who am I inspiring? And at the end of the day, all I can do is be me. Some people will see that as quite unique and quite exciting, and some people will find it quite frightening, I think, because sometimes there's also the thing about being the super VI, super visually impaired person, and I sometimes you meet them and you kind of think, oh, I'm never going to be that. And that's one of the things I want to try and get away from, because I think we've all got special uniqueness in us and we should be all given chances to be that super VI, because actually we're all super in lots of ways. But we're sometimes pitted against each other, and I find that occasionally frustrating. You know, if somebody says to me, well, I met somebody else visually impaired who could do what you were doing, and it's really been brilliant. They could do it, so why can't you do it? It's kind of like, well, because I'm me, and that other person's that other person. And I think there's something about that comparison which frightens me. So I think that's what frightens me more than anything else.
And I think sometimes it's also that thing of, you know, as visually impaired people, you know, we can't get away with people not noticing that we're visually impaired. I mean, I got my guide dog, and that's just a big advert for, oh, he's blind or partially sighted. So, you know, we can't do anything sort of secretly, can we? And I think sometimes the perception of the general public is very much they have a blinkered perception because they don't necessarily understand. And it's always that thing about, you know, sort of help or that embarrassing thing. And they'll say, oh, you know, how long have you been blind? You know, it's like, don't want you to ask that. I don't want to talk about necessarily that all the time. I don't mind talking about it, but I don't like it being the first thing that somebody wants to ask me about. You know, I'm me, you know, I'm not just the blind person or the guide dog owner or whatever. I'm me.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I work in a city centre. I travel around Manchester quite a lot. And I work in one of the busiest parts of Manchester, and you can guarantee, because I'm on public transport as well, it always comes up, and I never mind, like I never have a problem talking about it, but it's like I might be sat on the bus and then someone asks, you know, oh, how long have you been blind, or how much can you see, or, you know, I had a guide dog up until recently, so, you know, how long have you had your dog, all that kind of thing. And you have that conversation and it's all very nice and friendly, and then a couple of minutes later you get off the bus and there's someone else with the exact same questions.
Do you feel pressure, Callum, to give people that education?
Not so much pressure to educate people, but I think it's sometimes difficult to keep polite sometimes. I always feel a bit of a pressure to do that because we've all heard the stories of, you know, a visually impaired person who's having a bad day and then someone asks, you know, what might be to them quite a normal question, but it's maybe you're just not in the mood, or it's a bit personal, or to you it's a bit of a stupid question, and, you know, someone has snapped at them, and then that puts them off giving assistance. Then I've had a few people say that sometimes, you know, I tried giving someone assistance the other day who's blind, and they, you know, took it the wrong way. Or I always kind of have that in mind of, and it doesn't make any sense to me, but if I was someone who, like, snapped at someone or was a bit rude to someone for some reason, you know, sighted people tend to associate that to other blind people as well. I find
I make a living out of it. That's what I kind of think. In some ways it's kind of like that, it's my job, it's my bread and butter, the not knowing about how to deal with visually impaired people, blind, partially sighted, whatever label you choose, the label of the day, because we all have a label of the day. They always seem to change the terminology. You know, I make a living out of it, so there's part of me that thinks, well, actually, you know, quite like you guys being a little bit confused by it. But actually, deep down inside, I'd like to get rid of some of that confusion so I could move into the more interesting and more challenging conversations. So, you know, quite a lot of the times, for example, I test websites. There's some obvious stuff that people do on websites, and I almost do myself out of a job by saying, well, you can download this to test it. Then we can go through the more interesting bits about what your site isn't or is doing, instead of the same old superficial bits that we always seem to have to deal with.
So I think there's a lot of baggage that sighted people have around visual impairment, isn't it? It's always, you know, sort of, how do you do this? How do you do that? How do you get on the bus? How do you get up in the morning? How do you eat? And all that kind of stuff, which, you know, we just end up getting on with, and it's just stuff that we do because we've had to, you know, we've just, you know, it's like anybody else, you know, you wouldn't ask somebody sighted, you know, sort of, you know, how do you eat kind of thing. And it's just, you know, bonkers questions that people ask. But then that makes the day quite funny and interesting when somebody asks you a bonkers question and you just give them a bonkers answer and move on.
Oh, I've done that so many times. Yeah, where really I probably should have been serious. I think The worst one that I've done is I was waiting for a bus once and someone came up to me and it started off as the usual conversation. I was there with my guide dog. This was about 7 years ago. I'd not had the dog long. They said, oh, you know, lovely dog. And can I say hello to her? And I said, yeah, sure. You know, so they stroked her and said hello. And then they went, so which bus are you waiting for? And I told them. And she goes, bless her, this lovely little old woman. She goes, so when the bus pulls up, how does the dog tell you? I just went, oh, she barks the number out. Yeah, yeah, she just, you'll see when this bus pulls up, she'll bark 6 times. Yeah.
Or 34, that's a lot of barking to
Yeah,
do.
Exactly, yeah. I can't quite tell if she believed me, to be honest.
I scarily think she probably might do a little bit.
I just couldn't resist. I really shouldn't have done it. It just brightens your day sometimes, doesn't it?
But then you have to also think on the other side, when somebody newly becomes visually impaired, that fear factor. And that's the thing you kind of want to try and get rid of from people, because who knows what tomorrow's going to happen to somebody. And I think that's a bit, it's a horrible fine line that people have to travel. And I think we shouldn't knock ourselves if we get it right or wrong as well. And we so do. Oh, I didn't get that right. I should have said it this way. You know, and I think no one else questions yourselves as much as sometimes we do.
Is that part of, I suppose, in a way, thinking I've got to be right all the time? I've got to give this positive sort of, I suppose, impression of what a blind or partially sighted person has to do, or how we get around. It's like sometimes I get really frustrated if my guide dog, you know, for some reason doesn't take me to the right steps or something like that, and I'm sort of almost swearing underneath my breath. I'm trying to be careful not to swear on air. And you get very frustrated with yourself when you're not, you know, something goes wrong. And it's almost, A, you're frustrated with yourself, but B, you're thinking, oh, I bet people are watching me and they're seeing me not do this correctly. And I just, you know, I want to find that chair quickly. I just want to sit down. It's just sometimes you think, ooh, if only I could do that better next time, or if only people weren't watching, maybe was probably part of it.
Yeah, I sometimes think you feel clumsy, don't you?
When I first started work, my workplace is like big. We don't have our own kind of individual offices. It's just a big open plan office. And my workplace, to be fair, were really, really good. They put in a reserved desk for me so that I always had that consistent place, you know, to go to. I eventually learned my routes. You know, I could come out of the lifts upstairs, go through the main doors, and then, you know, I knew the way to somewhere that should ideally be free and some, you know, available for me to sit down at. Because of when I started, which was during COVID, it was very limited in terms of being able to get training for routes and things like that. But when the office opened up, I did want to go back in and I wanted to meet my colleagues, these colleagues who I've been dealing with virtually, entirely virtually for like 6 months, never met them in person. And there was a lot of pressure there, because the first time I met them, they saw me come into the office and just kind of stumbling around, and I'm walking into chairs, I'm walking up to people and nearly touching them, trying to find if the seat was empty. And I'm like, oh, great. They were not bothered. They were perfectly fine. But in my head, I'm thinking, this is a good first impression, isn't it?
And I think there's something about that human connection, isn't it? Actually, that everyone gets it wrong, really. Sometimes when you're all meeting somebody for the first time, people are all clumsy. But because we can't see them or see them as well, we kind of feel like we're going to get it wrong. And we put that pressure on ourselves. I think you get older, you don't care as much. I'm like getting into my mid-50s now and I'm becoming a bit, I don't care as much. Whereas I think when I was younger, I really wanted to be a super being. I think now the bits that frustrate me and also challenge me is the same old, same old. So it's like I'm thinking about, oh, you go into a room and nobody introduces themselves. And you kind of think, why can't we just go around the room and introduce ourselves? Why is it I've got to find out why everyone looks like so that I can find out somebody's Asian, you know, that, and because you can't always tell. And it's the little obvious things that you kind of think people still miss out on, and they just take certain things for granted. And then when you open your mouth and you say it, everyone else, sighted or not, suddenly turn around and go, oh, do you know, that's really helpful. Yeah, it's great for us to all introduce ourselves. It's great for us to find out, you know, bit of background about. And it's like, but you kind of, you're making it feel like it's just specially for me, but actually it'd be useful for everyone. And I think that's the kind of things I really want to get into in that nitty-gritty world that we kind of never seem to go to.
That's an interesting one, because I think during COVID, and we're all doing Zoom or Teams meetings, and there was always that sort of thing at the beginning where everyone would introduce themselves and everything else. And then, I don't know when it started, but which in some ways is a good thing, but sometimes I find a little bit frustrating, is people then describe exactly what they're wearing, what colour hair they've got.
Oh, yes.
And I think, okay, I don't necessarily need to know this for this Teams meeting or whatever. And then people get very sort of worried about describing themselves wrongly or whatever. And I just think, well, just tell me your name. That's all I really need to know. I don't need to know what you're wearing. But then I found that when I've been out and about and I've met people, and people say, well, I'm a white woman. And it's just like, okay, that's nice to know. But for me, it's not that important, but that's just me, I suppose.
That's interesting. I've not found that out and about. I've experienced meetings where they've done that, the physical descriptions. I've never really been that into it, just because I don't feel like it really matters. You know, I just want to get down to the point of the meeting sometimes.
I guess for me it does, because I kind of do want to know if there's other people like me in the room. Quite a lot in the arts still. There isn't many people like me. And whenever you do go into a space and you kind of do find there are people like you, you kind of want to gravitate towards them, or you want to find out more about them, and you kind of want to know. But I think there's a time and a space for it. So maybe not out and about, but in a meeting, kind of useful. But make it 3 seconds, not 3 minutes. Sometimes I actually do the obvious. I kind of say, I'm not quite sure what colour on top I'm wearing. So you absolutely know I'm visually impaired, because I haven't got a clue. And I didn't use my colour indicator today, so ha ha.
I never went on camera when I was doing the whole virtual meeting, just because I'm totally blind, so I wouldn't have a clue where the camera is or what they're looking at, or if they're just looking at my office, which is an absolute mess behind me. But when I first got chatting to people from work, as I said, it was all virtual at the time. So I just really quickly just kind of slipped in there. Like, oh, sorry, I'm not on camera. They were all fine with it. And the number of people who just kind of went, well, yeah, I'm not on camera either. But, you know, that's because it's lockdown. We're all a bit not in the mood, and I'm sat here in my jammers under a duvet.
Gave people freedom, didn't it? It freed people up to not have to look. And that was actually quite exciting in a sense. I found it really exciting, because it's suddenly like, we don't have to do the visual, doesn't have to be as important as the auditory, and we've all got to listen, and we've all got to communicate a lot better, and we've all got to connect a lot better. And it was like, in that sense, it was quite exciting. And before, I felt like, as a vision purpose, you're always on view, you're always being looked at. But in this sense, everyone else was making the obvious choice not to be looked at. And I thought, well, that means I'm not being looked at either. And it was quite freeing, I found it.
What sort of impact do you think, after the lockdowns were released and we were all out and about, did you get a sense that people were treating us all slightly better, you know, because of it? I don't know. My wife had health conditions, and she was on oxygen 24/7. And I think people had a better understanding because they'd seen people in hospital on oxygen. And when she was out and about, people were being a little bit more, I suppose, sympathetic to her and everything else. And from our sort of visually impaired sort of point of view, I wonder if COVID, you know, had a positive effect, I don't know, on people's perception.
I think one of the things it did have was it gave a lot more flexibility of how you worked and how you communicated. And I think that was a massive change. You know, a lot of people still do like going in the office, and I do work a bit in an office, but I also do work from home as well. And that freedom, and also it decreased that idea of you could be anywhere in the UK and still work. And that whole shift change was massive. But something that we'd fought for so long, mm-hmm. You sort of argued your case, and then suddenly this thing called Zoom came along, and it was like the world changed. And for me, that was really fascinating. But for you, Callum, that must have been really exciting, because tech must have just whooshed along.
Oh, it was huge. In a way, it was good, because I'd been saying, especially with tech jobs, because I had an absolute nightmare applying for jobs. Trying to get a job was probably the hardest job I've ever done, even with my university degree and stuff. Especially with tech jobs. I mean, I wasn't particularly looking for a work from home job, but when you're applying for jobs of like IT administrator or IT support or network support or security person, and I'm applying for all these jobs, and I was literally just applying for everything at one point, you know, places really, really far away from me. And I was saying, this is technology. You could do this remotely. And it was always met with a bit of a not too sure. And then, like you said, COVID came along. most jobs suddenly, okay, we've got to do this remotely. All right, yeah, that it can be done. One thing that has been easier for me with working from home is just being able to lay everything out and set everything out exactly how I need it. Like, I know that I can put my hand in one particular place and my work laptop's there. If I move slightly to the right, my Braille display is always there. I've got a layout for everything that's set up where I can be as productive as possible and I can just get to everything. And that's made life a lot easier.
Is that the same for you, Toby?
I think, yeah. I mean, my office where I'm sat at the moment, I mean, like Callum, I have everything in its place and I can quickly put my hand out and grab my Braille display or whatever. It's funny because from a radio point of view, it's been great. We can call people up and bang, you've got them there and then, and you're chatting to them and interviewing them. But there's also that thing, I do like actually interviewing people face to face, even though I can't see them, which sounds really bizarre. But it's that thing of interacting with somebody. But then again, remotely means that I can get people when they're free and when I'm free. And I think it's technology has helped.
Has it reduced some of the pressures for your work, Kieran?
I think it's a double-edged sword, because there's one thing you can beat six meetings on in one day, back to back, and you not have your lunch, because they're all kind of just flying at you. The other thing is that actually I do a lot of stuff where I do training, and I do visual awareness and guiding training, and you really have to be in the space to do that. There is that human connection, and when you're in the space, they see you moving about. Sighted people work out how to guide you a lot better. Talking it on a computer via a screen doesn't give that impact. So there's some things I think it's done really well, and I think having that hybrid way is quite exciting now. It means those people who can turn up can turn up. Those people who maybe find it a bit more difficult or something happens on the day, they can still come along.
Going back to a bit of the social aspect, one thing that I find really interesting is that when I'm out on my own and I'm going to and from work, or even when I'm in work and I see people who I don't often interact with, I find the reaction really interesting because they find it quite fascinating or quite inspirational, as we said at the start of this. But then my wife is fully sighted. When people see me out and about with her, usually she's guiding me. There's a lot more sympathy then. And a lot of the attention tends to be directed at her. I mean, I think we've all had the where you're in a restaurant and they say, what does he want to drink? Just ask me. But the number of times where she gets asked, are you his carer or are you his sister? And there's always a bit of surprise when they find out, oh, you're married.
My wife was on oxygen 24/7. And when we were living in London, she would be carrying around an oxygen cylinder. And when we got on the tube, it was always me with my guide dog, which would be offered a seat rather than my wife, who couldn't really, yeah, her mobility wasn't particularly that good, but it was like, no, offer the seat to the able-bodied blind person, but the person on oxygen, no, you can stand.
That's surprising.
My friend used to say, oh, I want my good look feel, so I'll just take you around sometimes, Kieran, because it makes everyone else smile at me, and then when I'm on a bad day, and they can smile, and I said, is that my use? And she said, no, you have other uses, you can get half-price tickets, you can take off a list of stuff. I found it fascinating that all these people were just smiling at her. You know what? It's just a friend. Someone walking about, and why on earth are you making that into such a big deal? But then I think it's that half world we live in, isn't it? It's like half the stuff's always accessible, and half the stuff we're still having to negotiate and make accessible. And that makes it kind of tricky for people to work out.
Do you think the general public who were sort of smiling at her thought, hang on, she's doing a good deed for that poor blind lady?
It is. It's a good deed week.
That's always how it comes across.
I always think I'm doing her the good deed, really. Actually, she's getting half-price tickets.
I remember being on holiday once and someone came up to us. He'd spotted us, me and my wife, and he'd been sort of looking over and watching how she was guiding me and how we were interacting and stuff. He'd had a few drinks, but he came over right up to my wife and like gave her a hug and was like, you're doing a great job. We were fuming because we're married. That's it. But it's just a normal marriage. But they were just looking at it as she's taken this poor blind person on holiday, I think.
I think there's lots of other sighted couples who probably one person always needs a bit more help in certain things than another person does. It's just that they can visibly see it. And I think that's the difference.
I think a lot of it comes down to what people's perception is. And, you know, people shouldn't be making assumptions about other people, should they? That's the thing which sort of is a bit frustrating.
you know, I'm not massive on social media, really. I go on Facebook and Twitter and I'm on Mastodon, but I don't really post that much, certainly not about my personal life. But we have got a lot of people now on social media, and they post, you know, videos about how blind people do things and how they live their lives, and they're on places like TikTok. But I really kind of hope that now we've got people like that who are on social media, they're out there, they're on the platforms that everyone's using. Are these perceptions going to change as a younger generation start to look at that and see that content, if it gets to the right people?
But also, are those people going to be the ones that then people are going to model us on? You know, a lot of them are white, good looking, slim, young. And I think there is that kind of fear factor in it as well, which is no different to any other lots of social media young people. But I think there is that, except it has a greater impact on us because you've already got enough pressures without having that put on it on top of the pile.
It must be so difficult because, you know, you're living your life in a way by social media, and whoever's up there, and whether it's somebody who's blind or partially sighted and portraying themselves in this kind of way, and although they're probably doing it in the best way and making a good image, but there's still so much pressure for the younger generation to sort of be like that person. And it, you know, sort of if somebody's seen doing something really good, we're going back to the, you know, that initial question, if I can't do that, does that make me a lesser person? You know, it's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's a problem generally with social media anyway, that everyone on there has got these like perfect lives. Even for them, the reality is not like that.
And I think the only way you can change it is by breaking the barriers down in a different way. When you do the things that you do every day, you change those little changes. I went to see a show and it was how people protest, young children protest. It was a kids show. And it was all about that actually it's the tiny things that make the big things happen. So sometimes people think it's that massive thing about social media, but actually probably what makes a bigger impact is the little things that we all do in our everyday lives. That's what I try and hang on to at the end of the day. It's like if I can make a tiny thing make a bigger impact, then I've done a good job.
What advice do you have for blind and partially sighted people who are listening, who might have felt some of these pressures we've talked about?
It comes down to being yourself, I think. To try and get on with your life as best as you can. And, you know, sort of if you need help or assistance, go out and ask for it and just try and manage, I suppose. That's how I've lived my life. I can't really say much more.
Yeah, I'm going to sort of repeat what Toby said here. Now, I've never really liked the whole say, you know, if you know, oh, just be yourself. But really, that is the only way you can be. You know, there's no two people who are exactly the same. If you're new to sight loss, especially, you know, it might feel ridiculous at the minute to say just be yourself, but it's all you can do. You don't have to be like any particular person. You don't have to be perfect at everything. The blindness doesn't have to, of course, it's a huge part of your life, but it doesn't have to completely take over your life.
I think don't be afraid to fail. Because from failure becomes a bigger success. Think, actually, you know, I've got that wrong, but how can I get it better next time? If you're living your life thinking, I'm going to get it all right all the time, then you're going to put yourself under a great deal of pressure. And I think that's the other thing. Don't be afraid to take risks. Don't be afraid of the world. Embrace it and make it work for you. Because when you make it work for you, you'll make it work for lots of other people too.
Well, thank you so much, Toby Davey, Kiran Saeed and Callum Stoneman, for joining us for Roundtable Talks on RNIB Connect Radio.
RNIB Connect Radio, celebrating 20 years of broadcasting around the UK.